This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Myrtle Beach. You know what's better than getting away to a beach? Getting together at the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They've got over 2,000 restaurants, live music playing all day and night, and endless attractions. This place was made for playing hard and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 Miles Where You Belong. The beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Before there was IMDb.com, there was Zach and Dustin.
You know those guys who think they know everything about a movie without having to go on the internet to look it up? Well, that's us, but maybe only for the years 1981 through mid-1989.
No, I'd say late 1978 through early 1992. Either way, we know movies. And even more specifically, we know soundtracks from those movies.
Yeah, this is $2 Late Fee with Zach and Dustin.
This is the podcast where we pick a movie and soundtrack from our youth that we loved and see if it still holds up today.
All in the spirit of positivity and togetherness. Thanks for listening. On to the show. On December 3rd of 2022, last year, last month, we had the pleasure, the honor, the ultimate achievement of broadcasting live from LA Comic-Con at the LA Convention Center with a live panel featuring director Joe Dante and executive producer Brendan Hay. Now, Joe, you might know. Joe directed Gremlins. Joe directed Innerspace. Joe directed The Howling, arguably the greatest werewolf movie of all time, not including Teen Wolf 2. Joe directed The Burbs, movies that have influenced us as people, as artists. And then our buddy Brendan Hay joined us as well. Brendan, EP of so many amazing things, and most importantly, the upcoming Gremlins, The Secrets of the Mogwai, out later this year, we think.
We certainly hope, but fortunately they were with us to chat about movies and music. You know, Joe has his own podcast, and he has been interviewed before, but he's never been on our show.
The Movies That Made Me, Movies That Made Me. It's a great podcast. It's very cerebral. If you guys haven't listened to it, it's just like a filmmaker's paradise. They just have guys come on, and well, guys and gals, but they talk about movies that influence them as filmmakers, or you know, showrunners, or whoever they happen to be, whether they're the directors, composers, writers. Real good stuff. You should listen to the one with Ethan Hawke, Zach, because it's really interesting.
Oh, they talk about the Explorers then, right?
Entire episode devoted to the Explorers.
Wow. Yeah, Joe hits on the Explorers. He hits on my favorite movie of his, Innerspace. Obviously, The Burbs. Tell some great stories about The Burbs. And Brendan is great to have on the show because he's kind of that connection between us and Joe Dante. And Brendan will be back on the show. Hopefully, Joe will be back on the show down the road. But we wanted to share this with you. It was a great opportunity to be at Comic-Con and have Jonathan London and the Geekscape crew get us in there. We joined Geekscape earlier this year, and my gosh, it's been nothing but joy being a part of the team.
You guys might not be aware, we are part of the Geekscape network, which is run by our friend Jonathan London. Tons of amazing geekified shows all over the lineup. We've certainly promoted some shows in the past, but we don't always mention it, and so now it's important to mention, hey, Geekscape, check it out, all the other shows. And this show today, totally live. So you actually hear a live audience in front of us.
Yeah, hopefully this will be something we can do in 2023. And check out Geekscape's plethora of shows. It's literally everything and anything you can think of that you're a fan of that has to do with fandom of some sort. So go check out the whole slate of Geekscape shows.
geekscape.net.
Enjoy this bonus episode of our interview with Joe Dante and Brendan Hay at LA Comic Con, courtesy of Geekscape.
Today, we are thrilled, gentleman to my left, good friend of mine, we've known each other for years, you know him as writer of such unknown things as The Daily Show, The Simpsons, Robot Chicken, he's the executive producer of Dawn of the Croods, he's the executive producer of Harvey Girls Forever, and of course, he's the executive producer of the upcoming Gremlins, The Secrets of the Mogwai. Coming whenever HBO Max figures out what they are and, you know, whatever.
Right.
Yeah, so, but please welcome, so happy to have you here, Brendan Hay.
Thank
everybody.
You so much for having me. Thank you, guys.
And the gentleman on my right needs no introduction. I consider him, along with Dustin as well, I think he would agree, one of the greatest directors of all time. He's responsible for Gremlins.
I don't know about that.
Gremlins 2. I'll just shout out some movies and you can cheer along. Gremlins.
Yeah!
Gremlins 2.
Yeah!
The Burbs.
Yeah!
The Howling.
Yeah!
Innerspace.
Yeah!
Piranha.
Yeah!
Please welcome Joe Dante. You may be humble and say, no, don't put me in that category, but sincerely, we hold you in that regard. You were responsible for bringing some of the most joyful moments to our childhood, getting to pass it on to our families. Thank you for just being the one who brought these films to life.
Yeah, but I got in on your formative years. when you weren't particularly critical.
That's true.
Yeah. But Joe, here's the test, right? Because we're a nostalgia podcast, and we, you know, things that triggered us as kids, positive, negative, whatever, we revisit those things on a daily basis. And I'll tell you, most of the time, it's not good. You know, like something that we loved. But I cannot think, and I'm not blowing smoke, I cannot think of a movie of yours that you watch now. It still holds up. Like they're maybe even better. I mean, honestly, like The Burbs is hilarious, and I just rewatched it recently, and you just have this moment where you're doing like slow close-ups of every character in the movie, and you slow close up on the dog, and it's like it's genius.
Well, it was not that appreciated when it was new. In fact, most of the movies that I did were not very appreciated when new. And in fact, most of the movies that people love from the 80s were movies that didn't get very good reviews and often didn't make any money. But the miracle of home video changed all that. And so now many of us who made pictures that were considered, well, I'll never work again after that one, that people don't remember. They all think they were hits because people still like them. And I mean, The Burbs, it was the worst review I ever got. It said, as empty as a movie can be without actually creating a vacuum. Wow, I thought, whoa, this guy's got no sense of humor.
No.
But now it's actually my second most popular movie, oddly enough.
You know, oftentimes people say Gremlins and is held in this high regard as a Christmas movie. I think we can all agree that Gremlins is a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
It's kind of perfect timing that we're doing this in December, having you on our show. But I got to fanboy a little bit on Innerspace.
Yeah.
Because if it wasn't for Innerspace, I don't think I would have been introduced to Sam Cooke, quite honestly.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, for real. Can you talk a little bit about Innerspace and how that all came to be?
Well, Innerspace, which is another movie that didn't make any money and got not very good reviews, but people did like it when they went to see it. The thing about Innerspace was that when I was first introduced to the script, it wasn't a comedy. It was a straight spy movie with the plot of a guy gets shrunk and put inside another guy. And I said, this is ridiculous. You can't make a serious movie out of this. And so I said, this will never work. And I went off and did other things. And then in the meantime, they hired a new writer, Jeff Boehm. And he said, well, what if it, his take on the material was, what would it be like if Dean Martin was shrunk down and injected inside Jerry Lewis? And that I understood, because I used to watch Martin and Lewis pictures when I was a kid. And it was one of the most fun movies to make, because the cast was just wonderful to work with, and Marty Short particularly was so funny, and so he would beg in Katharine Hepburn's voice, please, one more take, Joe.
And, one more take.
And take 10 would be different than take one, and sometimes you'd wonder, is that the same movie even?
Wow.
But he was great, and we had Spielberg backing behind us, so we had money for good special effects. In fact, it won an Academy Award for best special effects,
sure,
for Dennis Buren. And it's one of my favorite movies that I've done, and it was also one of the most fun to make, and it was released exactly the way I wanted it to be. In fact, I've been pretty lucky generally in that most of the movies that I've done have been pretty much released the way I wanted. There are a couple of glaring exceptions, but for the most part, whatever's wrong with them, you can blame me for.
Is there anyone you want to blame somebody else for?
Yeah, Explorers.
Well, can we talk? Who's a fan of Explorers, by the way, in the audience? I mean, it's a beautiful film. You know, we were watching that movie actually not that long ago, and the wonder and the excitement that the kids have, like, of building this machine. And that, I always say, the first two thirds of that film are just magical from a child perspective. They really are, because that's all we want to do is go into the forest and build something and have it come to life. It changed, right? From what it was originally supposed to be at the end.
Well, the problem is it wasn't really supposed to be anything at the end, because they were convinced at Paramount that this was going to be their next big hit, and they hired Wolfgang Petersen to direct it, and Wolfgang wanted to make it in Bavaria, and they didn't want to make it in Bavaria because they thought it would be too much like Neverending Story. Mm. And so they came to me, and the problem with the script was that it was all great until they went into outer space, and then they met some aliens and played baseball and went home. So, but there was a crush on to have this thing out at a particular time, no matter what. And so even though it wasn't quite there yet, we said, you know, I said, it's impossible to get this thing out when you want. And they said, but wouldn't it be nice if it could come out that? And I said, yeah, it'd be nice, but well, that meant I'll do it. And so we plunged ahead and made the picture, and making the last part of it up as we went along. And unfortunately, while we were shooting, the regime changed at the studio, and the people who hired me were gone, and had gone over to Disney. And the marketing people took over. And one of the things that, as soon as you say
back.
Marketing.
Yeah. That's so true. This is literally, yeah. the red dot hits you also. This is now the old regime.
Somebody being executed upstairs.
An alarm went off.
Yeah. It's the gremlins.
When the new regime comes in, the one thing they don't want to have happen is that the previous regime's movie is a big hit. And so they had this whole slate of movies that were unreleased, and they dumped them. They just said, we don't, just get rid of these. And so the movie was released unfinished. And so it was the rough cut, and there was nothing I could do about it. It was like, well, move it up 2 months and get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And so it was never completed. So it's you're watching the rough cut.
Oh, there we go.
It was getting too romantic in here. Thank God.
Well,
it's all right. The rough cut of the lights worked out.
Yeah. The rough cut, like, to this day. Whoa, there we go. It is literally the gremlins that are out.
You know, somebody's just leaning against the light switch outside or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right? So I think what the thing I was thinking about with Explorers was, even though that's the rough cut, it's still such a genuine, heartfelt film. Like, in these characters... Like, I don't feel like we have these characters necessarily today, child characters, that feel authentically childlike, you know, where they're talking to each other in a way that feels authentic, or they're looking at each other that feels like, you know, the look that they have.
Well, it's hard to do that. I mean, the problem at the time in the 80s was that most of the child actors were Disney graduates.
Yeah.
And they had been taught to be cute. And that's how you get jobs. That's how you get commercials. That's how you, you know, you have a career, is that you just, people just think you're adorable. And so there's a certain phoniness that comes in. And so we managed to find kids who were acted like real kids. And they had things to say about their characters. And they made them, you know, much more believable. And I for some reason, not having any kids of my own, I have kids in almost every movie I do. I don't know why that is, but I do enjoy working with kids. I mean, it's the one thing that that child actors give you is that you never know what to expect. Mm. You just constantly can be surprised. There's no method. There's nothing going on other than what they feel at the moment.
And Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix being two examples there of people that went on to, you know, the rest is history. But you didn't have any child actors in Inner Space, so to speak. You had a baby in there, spoiler alert.
Well, it's not a real baby.
No. It's not? I just want to go back to that really quick, because when you talked about it being one of your favorite films that you did back then, there's someone in that film that Dustin and I talked about who has reoccurring in many of your films, and that's Robert Picardo as the cowboy. And obviously, and he's in Burbs and the Gremlins and et cetera, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with him and how that all came to be?
Well, you know, the character of the cowboy couldn't be done today.
No.
It would not. First of all, he's playing a character outside of his ethnicity. Ooh,
yes.
Not supposed to do that anymore. But he's hilarious in it. And he's one of the funniest actors I've ever worked with. And I ever since the first time I worked with him on The Howling, where he was the only actor who would sit still for 9 hours having to put his makeup on.
Nine hours.
But if you see my movies, the same people appear over and over.
Yeah.
And that's not just true of my movies. It's any director. You look at their work and you'll see all these same people appearing both in front of the camera and behind the camera, and it's because you work out a working relationship with people, and they're your friends. And making movies is not that easy. So anything that makes it easier, such as having it be a communal experience with a bunch of people who like each other, it makes the product better, I think, or at least it has in my experience.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Agreed. And certainly, you work with many people multiple times. Dick Miller, Wendy Shaw, right? Many people. So it really is about that. Having that cohesive group for you and just knowing who's going
to show up. Well, it makes it easier to cast when you're reading a script, because you know you have a talent pool that you can pull from. You know, it doesn't mean you should put people into parts that they're not suited for. But it's one of the joys of making movies for me is actors.
That's a good reason to make movies.
Yeah.
Certainly, until the Paramount gets involved. And
We don't talk about
that. Right.
The lights are finally working.
I know.
Yeah, the Gremlins have worked their kinks out. And speaking of Gremlins, can we talk a little about the what's upcoming with Gremlins and how that's all coming to be?
Brendan, you mean the long-awaited?
Yes. shouldn't be as awaited as it is. And
you should have already been seeing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now Warner Brothers is going to take the
last one. Look out for the red dots of Sniper. But
I feel it somewhere.
No, 2023, barring further...
disruption.
Yes. It should have already been out, but it's ready to go. So once Warner Bros. Gets whatever becomes of HBO Max sorted. It will be out in 2023. It's looking great. We've gotten to show the pilot twice now, at least once at the Honestly Animation Festival, once at San Diego Comic Con.
And once here. No.
I wish I had something to share. But... Yeah, but it looks great. It is set in 1920s China. It is a prequel to the two films.
We're talking about Gremlins, Secrets of the Mogwai,
to be clear.
We didn't say the title, but...
It's to answer the ever-present question, when are you going to do Gremlins 3?
Yes.
That's all anybody asks. Right. Well, where is it? You know, well, here it is. This is it. And it dodges all the problems of being a sequel to a sequel. It's a prequel.
Yeah.
And it takes the Key Luke character, Mr. Wing, and he's now a kid in China, and he meets the Mogwai for the first time. Mogwai's very old, and he doesn't look it, but and it's animated, and it's really nicely animated, and it's funny and it's cute, and it's sort of a little dark, and then it gets a little darker, but it's still okay for kids.
Yeah.
And it sort of channels the spirit of the first two movies.
Yeah, that was the big goal was exactly that. That was it was great. Joe consulting throughout the project and like kind of being able to just be our North Star on everything. And it was always that thing of what I love about the movies. I think I told just one of the first times we met, but it's like for me, I feel like my sensibilities in so many ways were set by the first two Gremlins, seeing them as a kid. So I saw the first one probably as a little younger than I should have when I went with my older cousins to see it. Thankfully, in my own head, I told myself the Santa story couldn't totally be true. That must have just been, it's just a dad, it's fine. So some good cognitive dissonance saving me. But it was like, that totally gave me nightmares, but also set this love of like, oh, horror can also be fun. That horror is not just something that's scary, it's actually a really good time. And then the second one was just the, oh my God, you could do this? It's like, you can do all these, you can break the fourth wall and Hulk Hogan can come in, or you can have your movie introduced by Bugs and Daffy, and like, just, it was this eye-opening of what was possible. So, wanting to bring as much as we possibly can into the show of that, and make sure the laughs are genuinely funny, the scares are genuinely scary, and yeah, if we do traumatize a few kids, and then all the better for it.
And there's some voice cameos,
yes,
from people who were in the movies.
Yes, and a lot of little Easter eggs, yeah, trying to tie in.
Fans can watch it and say, "Oh, I didn't see that before." You know?
Just jumping back to the Phoebe Cates monologue that Brendan referenced, and if anyone hasn't seen Gremlins, you know, the Cliff's Notes is, why doesn't Phoebe Cates' character believe in Santa? And also, why has her dad been missing? Are kind of wrapped up in one, the darkest monologue in 80s movies, the darkest Christmas monologue, I would say. What was the origin of that monologue?
Well, that was actually in Chris Columbus's original script, which he was not even it wasn't even written to be produced. It was a sample, writing sample.
Really?
Yeah, wow. he was, you know, he just said, "Here's what I can do." And when Steven Spielberg saw it, he thought it would make a good horror movie because he wanted to start his new company, and the safest thing always is to make a horror movie because they usually make money, And so his idea was to make a low-budget horror film, which is why he came to me, because that was my specialty at the time. And then it became apparent that in order to make these Gremlins even halfway believable, it was going to cost more than $1.98. And so he went to Warner Brothers, and it became a studio movie, in which case everything changed a little bit because the original script was much darker than the actual movie was, and the mom got killed and her head got bounced down the stairs and they ate the dog. I mean, it was gruesome. And but in trying to make it more family friendly, it actually improved it, and so now it's become this weird touchstone. I mean, this movie is, what, almost 40 years old or longer? And I go to screenings all over the world where they huge amounts of people turn out to see it either for the first time or to bring their kids. Mm-hmm. And it always plays well with kids. I mean, there was a screening in France, it was dubbed in French, and it was packed with kids, and they were just on the floor. They just thought it was great. So none of us who worked on the movie can account for why it happens to still be so popular, but we're all very grateful.
So that monologue was a remnant of a horror movie.
And it was originally not from that character. There was another character. There was a scene in McDonald's where the Gremlins had eaten all the people and left all the McDonald's. And the guy who owned the McDonald's franchise, who was a character at the time, had that monologue. And so when all that disappeared, Phoebe's character was the girl, and I thought she needed something interesting about her, you know, to make it play. And so we said, well, she doesn't like Christmas. Why doesn't she like Christmas? And then so we said, here's why she doesn't like Christmas. Well, and so we repurposed that particular story. And at the first day's dailies of that story, the editor turned to me and said, "This is never going to be in the picture."
It would have been sad if Ronald McDonald was sitting down on the curb giving that story in clown makeup. That would have made a whole other different scene, I think, for that film. So, you know, I've shown the film to my son. He loves it. Gremlins 2, he loves even more because it's so over the top. I recently, obviously, revisited Gremlins 2 again.
and found it so engaging and so entertaining and so over the top to the next level. I don't think I quite got it as much when I was a kid. And so now as an adult, through nostalgic lens, I find it fantastic, you know.
Well, it's always nice when you can go back to movies that you liked when you were a kid and then see have them still be, you know, good, or see things in them that you didn't see before. My partner, Mike Fennell, who's produced most of my movies, he told me this. He was a kid, there was this movie that he saw, and it was just so upsetting, and he always had this vision in his head of this scene where this guy in a cape is standing on a porch, and a light comes, and the guy falls down, and then they pull the cape off, and he's a skeleton. I said, Mike, that's Plan 9 from Outer Space. But when you're a kid,
yeah,
you know, you don't know. You don't notice the cheesy backcloths, yeah, and you don't notice the cardboard tombstones and all that. You just pull what you need out of it.
You've had, actually, so many of your movies have a lot of amazing special effects in them. Again, Inner Space, for example. But and so over the top, the special effects. Was that challenging to do when you were making that film?
Well, special effects are always challenging. I mean, the bar changes,
you know,
and the technology changes. And now we have CGI, which is a wonderful tool to make, you know, the sky look green, whatever you want, and it's much more prevalent in movies than you think. I mean, there's so many movies that you've seen where they're just what looks like an ordinary scene is actually almost and totally fake. You know, it's a cityscape that goes on forever, or it's a sunrise or a sunset or whatever, and it's not real. All of which was great, but I harbor an affection for practical effects, and practical effects are the things that you do on the set. Like, for instance, the Gremlins were puppets, mm-hmm. and they were a pain in the ass to work, and they were very complicated, and it took many, many people to make even one Gremlin look like it was doing something that made sense. But it was worth it in the end, because not only do they have a tactile presence, but it gives the actors something to relate to, something to look at. I mean, I've done movies later, like I did a Looney Tunes movie, where the characters were never on the set because they're always going to be put in as animation later. And so the actors have to be able to be trained to look at a certain point in space that when you put a character in there will look like they're actually looking in the right place. Brendan Fraser was particularly good at doing that. But it's much more difficult for the actors. When the green screen Star Wars movies started coming out and you had these scenes with all these very, you know, classy actors on these green screen sets, and you get this impression that they don't know where to move because there might be something here or not, and they don't know the boundaries of their set, they don't know where it ends, and there's a certain tentativeness to the acting in those scenes. And I think it's much easier to just do stuff for real, or as much as real as you can make it, without having to ask people to imagine stuff. As you know, in all the Ray Harryhausen movies, obviously there was nothing there for the people to look at, and they had to master doing, you know, it's over here now and it's over here now. It's very hard to do, and I'm a big fan of practical effects. I think a combination of practical effects and CGI is probably the best combination.
What did you grow up on as a kid that made you connect with that had practical effects?
Well, I'm a child of the 50s, and you know, you guys look at the 80s the way I looked at the 50s,
yeah.
Because you're looking back at the things that affected you when you were kids, and in the 50s, this was the atomic fear age, and you know, every time a plane flew over, we thought it had a bomb in it, and so there was a lot of paranoia, but there were also a lot of science fiction and horror movies that taught you not to trust authority. And that your friend the atom was maybe not your friend, and a number of them, you know, some of the pictures, War of the Worlds and Forbidden Planet, This Island Earth, those pictures all had state-of-the-art special effects for the time, and many of them still hold up today.
Yeah,
and so the idea of seeing things that were, you know, Billy Wilder, I think, once said, if I want to see what people are doing next door, I'll go next door and see the guy next door. And, you know, I don't want to make movies about the guy next door. I want to make movies about things that people can't see next door. And so I got into this whole idea of making things that were bigger than life or, you know, weirder than life.
When you do the guy next door in the burbs, there are cannibalistic maniacs that are living next door. So.
Well, but that was based on the idea that almost everybody that you talk to can talk about a time in their life where they lived in a neighborhood where there was somebody, there was some house or some family or some group that everybody was afraid of, or everybody would talk about it. Everybody would be afraid, don't go to that house. There's crazy people in there. You know, and it was really quite common. And I think that may be one of the reasons why the picture is still so popular.
I agree. I mean,
yeah, the Burbs, I feel like you mentioned this at one point, that the Burbs could really be like a stage play because it's all limited to one neighborhood, one.
Well, there was a writer's strike that year, and so when we were doing the movie, we said, well, let's do it. They wanted to do the Burbs in a real place, like in Arizona or something like that, and I pointed out that, you know, we blow up a house. People don't like it. They don't like it when you blow their houses up in neighborhoods. It makes it very difficult to get the permit. And so I said, besides, this shouldn't be a realistic movie. This should look like a backlot movie. This should look like a 40s or 50s kind of movie. And so the Universal backlot had recently been reconfigured because Steven Spielberg built Amblin on what was the old backlot, which you see in Leave It to Beaver. But it was a great backlot, and they took the houses and they willy-nilly put them up on a hill next to each other. So you had houses from a 1930s movie next to a 1950s movie next to a 1970s movie, and so there was no integrity to the plan of the place, and it was just that off, just slightly off, but very homey and looking lived in. And so we said, well, let's do it up there, and we were the only picture shooting in Hollywood that summer because of the strike, the writer's strike. And there was just us and the raccoons and the deer. And it was really a lot of fun to go to work every day because with that cast was so much fun. And because we were able to shoot it all in one location, I said, look, let's shoot it in sequence so that if the actors decide to ad-lib something or take it in a different direction, we can follow it, you know, and we can, as opposed to other movies I'd seen where people would do improvs and the improv didn't quite work because it was not, they had already shot the part that comes after the improv and it didn't match. But this way, if we want to find out why Tom Hanks didn't go to work that day, or that, you know, if he's good, it turns out he's been fired or whatever, we can work that into the script because the writer was not allowed to be there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's in the movie. I hired him as an actor, which I often do with writers to get them on the set.
Yeah.
But in this case, we really had to kind of make it up as we went along. And it was, and what's funny is in the first mix, you could still hear the Jaws ride in the background. You know, and then there's the tour. You know, the Universal tour. Yeah. Which makes much more money than any single Universal picture, and so all of the stuff that they do at Universal and have done since the tour started, the movies take second seat to the tour. If the tour comes in, they don't want to stop shooting. So what they do, and I remember this because I remember the first time I took the tour. I'm on the tour, and I look and I see Claude Akins is over there doing a scene from Sheriff Lobo. And with some other actor, and they're, and they, meanwhile the announcer of the tour is going, oh, and over here we have a Claude Akins, and they're shooting, and everything is dubbed later. That's why when you watch a Universal TV show, there's a certain hollowness to the sound because almost all the dialogue has been added later because you can't use any of the dialogue while the tour is going by. Very interesting.
Wow.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Myrtle Beach. You know what's better than getting away to a beach? Getting together at the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They've got over 2,000 restaurants, live music playing all day and night, and endless attractions. This place was made for playing hard and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 Miles Where You Belong. The beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
This episode is brought to you by Beyond Natural Pet Food. Beyond Pet Food helps me care for what matters, my pets and my world. They help me nourish my pets with high-quality natural ingredients, like wild-caught salmon and organic free-range chicken. Beyond also has responsible sourcing practices and a long-term partnership with the Nature Conservancy. Beyond Pet Food, your pet, your world. Learn more at beyondpetfood.com.
Brendan, can you talk a little bit about how you got connected with Secrets of the Mogwai?
Sure. This is the case where fandom came in handy. Audrey, our exec on Gremlins, I've known for a decade or so, had worked with her prior. We were just doing like our every 6 months, kind of like, oh, just catching up, grabbing lunch. And she's like, oh, we might be doing some things with Amblin. And before she even, I think, finished saying Amblin, I'm like, if it's Gremlins, I want in. And like 3 months later, she's like, so you're in luck. We actually are. And that was it. Zee-Chun, who's the showrunner, the other EP, he came in with the take that was like, I don't know if it was him or somebody else of the doing the prequel, but he had the fleshed out version of it. So yeah, I just met with Z at that point and was blown away by his, as he laid it out, of like, it was like Joe said, just made sense of like, this is how you tell another story. You don't have, because it is, I don't think you may have said that Gremlins 2 is sequel proof. It is, I don't know where you go further from that point. So it was instead like, oh, but to go back in time and especially grounding it in Chinese mythology, and it's just a totally different angle that you haven't explored yet, and it's just a really fun way to flesh out the world and do so much more with the Mogwai, and also with Mr. Wing and seeing him as a kid, and getting to introduce a whole lot of other elements to play with, so it's been super fun. But yeah, the if I hadn't interrupted somebody with to express fandom, I wouldn't be working on it.
Well, clearly you're not a fan because you're wearing a sweatshirt that has a bunch of Ghostbuster characters on
it.
Yeah, kidding.
Officially licensed.
How many episodes is it going to be?
We got 10 episodes in season one, and season two is currently in production, which will be another 10. So yeah, 2023 and beyond.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Wow. And you guys started pre-pro in 2014? I feel like it's been...
It's 2019 when we began. So we had one full year in person before everything happened. It's amazing. It's been the joy that animation was able to continue into pandemic, no problem. I've gotten to see every actor's closet, because they all had to, as you guys as voice actors, everybody turned their closet into their makeshift studio at home. Right. So... it's been really fun to see the inside of everybody's stuff. Definitely, there's one actor in particular who I don't think we've revealed yet, but once we do, I can officially say has the nicest closet of anybody. Yeah. There's like a clear winner. Our Gizmo, AJ Locasio, had maybe the most makeshift of the batch, but it's been great. So proud of the show, and so excited for everybody to finally see it at some point.
Someday.
Yeah. Hard to beat Howie Mandel, though, you know, as the...
Oh, Howie's a classic.
Yeah. Howie's a classic, but Howie didn't want to be Gizmo anymore.
No. But when he was Gizmo working with Howie, it's like to this day, it's an often imitated voice.
Well, he actually, Howie had done that voice previous.
Yeah.
He had a sort of a baby character.
Skeeter. Yeah. He was a Skeeter on the Muppet Babies and then Bobby's World.
Yeah. Yeah. Same voice. Same range.
Yeah. It was coming from somewhere. And and he was obviously, he's great. And also he's an ad-libber. Ad-libbers are great.
Brendan, you were saying you're fanboying, and Joe's, well, having Joe here, is Gremlins your top Joe Dante film?
Gremlins and Gremlins 2. It's kind of, it can depend on my day between the two. Innerspace and The Burbs would probably be the other ones right up there, and Howling terrified me the first time I saw it as well, so we kind of get to jump between them. I also have a soft spot for Matinee.
Yeah, really absolutely. Matinee fans out there? Any Matinee fans out Interspace, was there ever an idea that Interspace would be a sequel or have a sequel?
I don't think it was planned, but if you look at the movie, it looks like it's set up for a sequel.
We was really hoping there would be.
Well, the idea of having the villains, only being this big for the entire sequel was pretty daunting.
The size of a gremlin, you could do that now. Small soldiers, you tackled that pretty much.
That was Gremlins 3.
Yeah. Small Soldiers, I say, is the, it's not R, but the R-rated version of Toy Story. It's like, it's the action version of Toy Story. You do such a great job, though, I think, of making movies that are accessible to kids as well. I mean, I think not all of your films are PG or PG-13. However, they all can be, like, there's an aspect that has that family-friendly but also terrifying, too. you know.
You've ever been in a family?
Well, I mean, my son, for example, when we watch Gremlins, the first one, he loved the scene where the mom is attacking all the gremlins, you know, and he was just like, this is so great. He was just cheering practically, you know, and which was, to me, I was looking at him going, this is awesome. I want to show him, I can't wait to show him Gremlins 2.
Yeah. I was going to say, on that, because it was something we talked about in the writer's room that we tried to keep in the show, as we rewatched both Gremlins movies a whole bunch, it's a kid's entry point to horror, we kept always saying.
Yeah.
It felt like it's like, okay, it's, you know, it's the mom being attacked, but it's like, it's your mom kicking ass.
Totally.
It is, right. I think you've said it in things, it's a boy and a dog. It's kind of like, there's elements that always ground it back to this kid point of view, this kid wish fulfillment, this kind of like, you want to be on this adventure yourself.
I love seeing a mom kick ass,
yeah.
By the way. That's really great. So would you say making movies in the 80s was totally different than it is now, obviously, with the completely 100%. But this idea of nostalgia, keeping these movies alive, revisiting them and having more of a fondness now, is there a film, you said the Inner Space is one, but are there films that you look back on in the 80s specifically that you have revisited and go, I have more of a fondness now for it than you did back then?
You mean of my own or other?
Yeah, of yours, yeah.
Well, you know, it's like asking, you know, which one of your kids do you like the best? You know,
well,
it's
like, that's easy to answer.
I like the little crippled one. You know? they all have things that annoy me, and they all have things that make me happy. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm just I marvel at the fact that the scripts are so good. Very frequently are, and sometimes I just get lost watching the actors.
You brought up Matinee.
Oh yeah.
And that's is that a personal film to you?
Yeah, I was the same age as the lead kid and during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which we all thought was going to be the last day, last weekend. No school on Monday or ever. there's a lot of stuff of mine, a lot of the props and things that the kid has in his bedroom or stuff from when I was a kid, drawings that I made when I was a kid,
oh, wow.
Movie posters. I mean, in that sense, it was all very personal. But unfortunately, no horror movie makers came to my neighborhood and we wanted to premiere their new movie during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mostly, we just worried that we were not going to be able to grow up.
You've stepped away from obviously making movies, but have there been any movies of recent that you've saw and go, wow, that's something that needs to be appreciated more? Or
well, I would recommend Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which is I think the greatest stop motion movie since King Kong.
Wow,
that's really cool.
It's really good.
Because I think that's obviously having you on our show and people talk about, well, I love Inner Space and I love The Burbs and I, you know, and you were thinking, well, where were these people when the movie first came out?
Right? Some of them weren't born.
Yeah, that's true.
It's true. And like most movies that we do cover on our podcast, there are like second lives, you know, video stores, obviously. And HBO, usually, you know, cable, yeah. That just picked it up. And then they were just...
You know what HBO stands for? Hey, Beastmaster's on.
I didn't know that. That's really good. That's really good. You just hit us with two things. Pinocchio is the best stop motion since King Kong. And
Beastmaster.
And Beastmaster. Whose name is Dar, I believe?
Dar.
Is that what, yeah.
Don Coscarelli directed that. I love that movie.
Yep.
Inner Space, thanks to our good friend David Irons, he brought up that Inner Space was one of the first movies to ever come out on VHS in widescreen format.
That's right.
Did you fight for that?
I am very proud to say that I got it done.
Wow. Amazing.
So I will say, as a child, watching it on a 13-inch TV, when it first came out, I said, I can barely see the picture, right? Because it was so small, not understanding or recognizing the whole importance of widescreen versus pan and scan. But
you know,
now,
I remember Woody Allen complaining that Manhattan came out, with Letterbox, and he said, people wrote and said, when we saw the picture in the theater, they had heads and legs, and now they don't. I mean, I don't know how you explain this stuff to people. But now we have widescreen TVs, and everything is, you know, I would have made many more movies in scope if I thought that they weren't going to end up being panned and scanned.
How hard was that to get that actually pushed forward?
That was Spielberg was very supportive. He was, and I was on a DGA panel about trying to make sure that people, that movies weren't colorized and that they were shown in their proper ratios and all that kind of stuff. And so that was kind of a thing that was going on at the time, and this was sort of in the forefront of it. And it was like, well, if this sells, then I guess we can do more of it, and it became common.
Yeah, it seems like Interspace actually got a bigger shelf life once it premiered on VHS, and that's fantastic.
Everybody on this panel is a creator of some sort, and I was just kind of curious what everyone finds to be the biggest obstacle outside of your own, personal talents and things like that. Is the greatest obstacle the studio? Is it we don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but like to me, having produced television, I always said, this would be so fun if the network didn't exist. because they always weigh in with the dumbest
stuff.
Yeah,
but unfortunately, somebody's got to give you the money.
That's what I was going to say.
Of course, but you mentioned Paramount. Is that...
Well, that was a particularly bad situation. It was nobody's fault. I mean, it was just this, it was a change in leadership, and they decided that they didn't want to be tarred with the makings of the leavings of the previous administration. I don't know.
Yeah, I always feel like it's weird. It's the double-edged sword of it. One, it's they're the only people who can actually finance it, but it's just the hardest part is the first step. It's getting one yes is the infinitely hard part. Just because everybody wants that yes. There's so many projects going forward. You have no idea what else was pitched that day, how anybody, even just an exec, was feeling. I've been grateful, though. I'd say I've had more good execs than bad execs in my days of working on shows and coming to 20 years now type of thing. So, yeah, I do think a lot of times, and especially on Gremlins, we've actually had Warner Bros. Animation and Amblin could not have been more supportive, and both financially and creatively. So it's like they add a lot. They are sometimes the fresh perspective that's needed outside of a crew, outside of the exec producers or director or stuff like that. It's like, oh, we did miss that. Or that is a good idea to think about. So I always feel bad. It's like you shouldn't, I don't ever want to throw them out because there's a lot of good stuff that comes out of the process. It's just, I wish they had more yeses.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for these people, we wouldn't have jobs.
Yeah.
So there's a certain responsibility that comes with that.
That is an absolutely great point. But a lot of times the person who's overseeing the project, might not have a knowledge of something like sacred characters.
Or what's worse, sometimes they're actively against the project, and it's being it's being made over their objections.
Yeah. Yeah.
And nonetheless, they're still in charge of it. So they still tell you what to do, even though they would never go see your project. They don't care about your project. They don't give a shit about anything.
Yeah.
But that's just the way that the system is set up, and that isn't going to change. I mean, we're always going to need patrons. We're always going to need people to be able to say, here's some money, do something. The problem is that once they hire you, they should let you do it. Why don't you let me do what I do? They hire people for their talent, and then they second guess them.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that almost always ends up badly.
Yeah. We want to be mindful of your time, of the room's time. We want to open up to a few questions. Does anybody have questions? Okay. All right. Why don't we start in front? Peter, why don't you ask?
Jerry Goldsmith, you work with a lot. Is any of his themes from Gremlins in the new series, or can you allude to that?
I believe so.
Yeah, two pieces.
Oh, the question for anybody who didn't hear was Jerry Goldsmith, who you've worked with a lot. Is any of his music in the new project?
Yeah, I don't know if I can say which, but yes.
In the front, in the third row, go ahead.
You said the difficulty of getting the yeses. How did the series Erie, Indiana get greenlit? how did that come about?
No, Erie, Indiana was kind of a forerunner of the X-Files.
Totally.
It was the junior X-Files. And it was not my idea. It was Carl Schaefer and Jose Rivera created the show, and they asked me to do the pilot, and I enjoyed doing it, and I stayed on to be the, quote, creative consultant, which is a great job, because you get to tell people stuff, and if they don't do it, you go,
And you get paid for it.
And you get paid for it. But it turned out that I remember we ran the pilot for Warren Littlefield, who was head of NBC at the time, and I remember they don't like to in the room tell you that they like you or don't like you. They just are polite. But I saw him turn to some guy and mouth, "It's great." And so we got picked up. Unfortunately, we got put in the time slot opposite 60 Minutes, which is one of the biggest shows on television. And our lead-in was two disc jockeys with a sort of a disc jockey Mark and Brian TV show, which no one was particularly interested in. And so we got terrible ratings, a little later, they decided that the problem with the show was that the lead kids were too young, and they wanted to introduce an older kid, and get rid of the kid that we had. But then the whole thing fell apart anyway, and so the last episode of the show, the lead kid discovers he's in a TV show, and he's being replaced by this other kid, and that's the episode where I play myself. A role I was terrible in after a lifetime of rehearsal. Still terrible. But nonetheless, it was a great episode. It was a wonderful show. It's not that easy to find, although I think it's on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. But it also suffers from the fact that although it was shot on film, it was edited on tape, and they didn't save any of the film. So they can never do a Blu-ray. They can never do anything nice. It's all from this one tape that exists, and it's okay. It's watchable. It's just a little fuzzy, but I really love doing that show.
Got time for one more thing, in the back with the Wookiee hoodie on.
For the Twilight Zone movie, did you choose the story that you wanted to direct, and if so, what made you choose the story?
Well, when I was approached for
the question was about the Twilight Zone movie. Sorry to interrupt. Just for anybody.
When I was approached for the Twilight Zone movie, John Landis and Steven Spielberg had the franchise, and they wanted to make a feature version for Warner Brothers. And I was actually working on Gremlins at the time in pre-production. And so they said, well, let's have Joe do one. And then one day George Miller came in and talked to Steven, and he said, oh, there's George, let's have him do one. It was very ad hoc. The problem, I thought, with the movie was that they wanted to remake old episodes. And I thought, well, this is terrible. You're going to make a feature film with feature film money, and you can now have money to make these stories that they were doing on Twilight Zone, but now you have real money to spend on them. Let's do what Rod Serling would have done and adapt something that's hasn't been done before.
Yeah.
No, they've got to be the old ones. I said, but the stories, they thrive on the fact that they have twist endings, and the fans know all the twist endings. So if you do the show, they're gonna all be ahead of you, and they're gonna that's what we want. Yeah. So I picked an episode which is one of the best episodes actually, but I tried to change it around enough so that hopefully the audience wouldn't realize until halfway through which episode it was a remake of, and it was a lot of fun to make that movie, but of course it was colored by the fact there was a terrible accident early in the shooting, and I didn't think they didn't go ahead with the movie, but they did. And so George and I were able to make these rather odd little episodes with big money behind them, and no interference from the studio. Mm-hmm. So we figured, boy, this studio filmmaking is pretty cool. They give you all this equipment and all these big crews and everything, and they leave you alone. I mean, this was great. Well, we both learned on our next picture that that's not the way it works. It was only because they didn't really want to put their hands on this movie because it was so controversial. So they just wanted to leave it alone and still try to make money from it. But it was a great experience for us, and it certainly put me on the map, and didn't hurt George either.
Really quickly before we wrap up, Brendan, is there anything you want to promote, or you want to shout out your Instagram or anything like that?
Gremlins, Secrets of the Mogwai, 2023, HBO Max.
2024.
2024. Yeah, maybe all of the above.
Yeah, let's keep going. Yeah.
We keep joking that if we don't premiere by next Comic-Con, since we showed the pilot last Comic-Con, episode 2 this Comic-Con. Gremlins, Secrets of the Mogwai, HBO Max. Very excited for everybody to see it.
Joe, is there anything that you want to
No, I just got my website, Trailers from Hell, and I've got my podcast, The Movies That Made Me, which is a competing podcast. Don't tell them.
It's a little bit, we're niche. We're
it's
niche.
A little different. Well, yeah. We're niche too, boy. Boy, are we niche.
You can have two niches.
You don't make any money, do you?
No, but you talked about patrons, and we do have a Patreon page. If you go to $2 Late Fees Patreon page, please sign up.
Well, we have a sponsor, but we still don't make any money.
Working on that.
But anyway, it's a great podcast.
It is.
Agreed. Brendan, Joe, it's a pleasure. It's an honor to have you both on our show. Can we have a big round of applause for our two guests? I dance like the cowboy because of the cowboy. So thanks to the cowboy, that's where I got my lasso. I literally hook people in all the time because of the cowboy.
Sing us out. Sing us out.
I will.
Come on.
That's,
do the song.
I'm an old cowman. I don't want it. I could get in trouble, actually. That's my bunse. Hi.
Thank you guys for all coming.
Thank you so much for
coming.
Thank you, Geekscape.
Yeah.
I'm an old cowhen from the Ogrin, but my leg's not bold and my face's not thin. I'm a cowboy who's never seen a cow, can rope a steer 'cause I don't know how, and I'm not for to start learning how. Yippee-i-oh-hi.
Listen, I just wanted to say goodbye and remind you that the good guys always win, even in the 80s.
All right, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it.
Don't forget to subscribe and give us a four...
Is it 5-star rating?
Don't forget to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. We'd really... Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes. If you listen to us on Spotify, that's great too. And you can find us on the internet. Don't forget to check out our website at $2LateFee.com and follow us on Instagram and Facebook at $2 Late Fee Podcast. We'll see you next time.
We did it.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.